All right, as you can see here on February 13th, this will be our eighth class. We've been through seven complete lessons now as introduction to first Leviticus and then Deuteronomy. But we've been looking at overarching themes. We saw, for instance, in one class, all of the sacrifices. Last week we looked at what covenants are themselves. And tonight, in a similar vein, we're going to continue with overarching thoughts about Moses' law, the heart of which, at least as it involves the priests, is found in this book of Leviticus. And so I went online and hunted all around and found this particular chart, which I then erased a bunch of stuff off of. And using this as our foundation for the entire night tonight, we're going to be talking about the feasts that God had asked the Jews to participate in. And so this is your standard Jewish calendar, and it's the typical way that people will present them, you know, in a circle like that. I was particularly happy to find this one because I think even at the furthest reaches of the building here this evening, you'll still be able to read this and see that it's kind of like a combination lock, if you will. But, you know, using just the center here, this is January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, the course of our months. So in the blue, with January up here at the top, here's how we keep time. Here's how we think of the year under what's typically referred to as a Julian calendar. Now, of course, you're not going to know any of the months as they're designated by the Jews, but the Jewish year is skewed two different ways. They don't think of their new year as January 1 the way we do, and I'll show you more on that in just a minute. But their months also don't line up. They're shifted almost perfectly half a month. So if you pick any given, let's use Nisan, I think it is the first month. Nisan here actually begins in the middle of our March and ends in the middle of our April. So you have this offset in two different ways. This actually is the ancient New Year. So the first day of Nisan, which was their first month, they should be beginning their year in the middle of our March. That's the calendar that God had established for them, or at least that they were using at that time. Oddly enough, today the Jews now have two New Years. And I don't right and properly understand that, to tell you the truth. They're all well aware, and of course they're trying to claim at least that they have some relationship to the God of the Bible. So this would be it. But instead, they also have a new year that they think of that's over here in this month of Tishri. So don't be surprised if twice in a year you hear Jews are celebrating the new year. You know, Rosh Hashanah is over there, you know, in Tishri, not in what would typically be considered the first month of the year. So what you do then is you just number these and went ahead, you know, and just did the circle here so that they still have 12 months. Their months each have 30 days. They operate off of a lunar system rather than the solar one that we do. And so where we will have a leap year and add an extra day to February every 4 years, what they will do is add an entire month at the end of every 12 years, I think it is. You know, there's a 13th month, and they play catch-up all at once with an entire month. And so timekeeping, as we've mentioned so many times in our studies of the Old Testament, is really frustrating and difficult. You just have to accept that it's a struggle. The peoples of all nations have had their own varying ways of deciding how they're going to keep time. There hadn't been a Greenwich, you know, mean time yet. And so everything is kind of offset and it becomes a struggle. Still, what we're going to be studying tonight are these various feasts that are based on events in the time of the year, typically, or in religiously significant events. But I'm going to start over here, and I realize that's a little small just to squeeze it in, but their plowing time, what we would think of then as the start of any year's seasons of crops, is over here long about the time, the last half of our October and then November. It's their eighth month of Kesvan. That's when they would start plowing. The next month, their ninth month, Kislev, our November, December, is when they get really serious about planting various grains. Then you skip all the way over to their 12th month over here, our February, March, and they will be getting a citrus harvest coming in. Now, before I go any farther, bear in mind, Israel is an extremely small country. On a straight line, it's only something like 150 miles. At its furthest point, I think it's only 50 miles wide. So it's considerably smaller than any number of states in the United States, an awful lot smaller than our own state of Oregon right here. But it has all the elevation changes you can imagine, and all of the seasons, and all of the crops. It's a fabulously productive country. And why not? When God offered it to them as their promised land, he referred to it as a land flowing with milk and honey. So right off the bat, you know it's going to be a very green place, because to have milk from any of the quadrupeds that produce it, you need a lot of pasture land. You're going to be needing some grass. And then if you're going to have the bees for the honey, what also are you going to have virtually everywhere? You're going to have flowers, all kinds of plants that are then going to be blossoming and all that pollination going on. So they can plant just about any crop you can think of. They got date palms and palm trees down by the Dead Sea, lowest place on earth, of course, and then every other crop on up the chain, you know, to cold weather things as well. So they got a citrus harvest coming in our February, March. And then in the next month, which we're looking at the season of crops, would be their first month, is our first fruits. Now, they're already bringing in crops. We just talked about the month before having a citrus, but they are now bringing in the bulk of the year's crops, some not quite 6 months after the plowing and the planting have been going on. The next one there, in their second month here, is their barley harvest, and then in the third month will come their wheat harvest. And finally, over here in the sixth month is the grape harvest. In the seventh month is the olive harvest. Grapes over here, August, September. Olives in September, October. You've completed the year. They're bringing in the olives. What's the next thing you do? Plow the ground next month and start it all over again. It's a great country. Somebody's bringing in some kind of crop or working the fields for some reason virtually all the time. So it's green and growing. It's beautiful in every sense. And that calendar, in those days, of course, pre-industrial revolution and all of that, is based on agriculture and based, of course, on livestock. So there will be, when we get down now to the feasts, these ceremonial days of observance and various activities that God imposes upon them, there are two big seasons for the feasts. There will be three of them in the spring, and there will be three in the fall. Three major holidays that take place in the first month, Nisan, or March, April, and then there'll be three more over here in the seventh month of Tishri. So just exactly 6 months apart, they have these clusters of festivals that have been introduced since Exodus and working our way all the way through to Deuteronomy. Passover, of course, is first and foremost. We'll have much to say about that in just a minute. It will be followed immediately, so much so that the Feast of Unleavened Bread is often just combined with it. And they'll say Passover, and they mean both. Or they'll say the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, and they include the Passover. They're two separate feasts, but they're door-to-door next to each other and consequently usually treated as one. Then we have, as I pointed out in the small red letters, you know, first fruits, you have an actual festival for the first fruits. Coming over to the fall feasts, and remembering going in order, the Feast of Trumpets would come first, and so I'll be going up instead of down on those three. But there's the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and then the Feast of the Tabernacles, sometimes called the Feast of Booths. Now, you're aware of this already. I'm sure we've been studying other Bible books and seen recently, in fact, how they, after the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C., created three more feasts on their own and got kind of rebuked for it. But nonetheless, the Jews have the ones that God has given them, and some more that I haven't listed yet, and a lot more. Some are ordained by God, some are invented. But have they ever got a full holiday schedule? If you're looking for a country with a lot of time off, Israel's the place to be, because there's whole lots of these holidays going on. This one right here, Pentecost, also known as the Feast of Weeks, because it's seven full weeks after your Passover. This is also an extremely important one of these festivals. It does not fall in the spring or fall seasons, but Pentecost, 50 days after Passover, we'll have much to say about tonight. Now, you may have noticed that on three of these, I have a little red arrow at the head, and I've added one at the back here as I'm highlighting it now. But the Passover, this Pentecost, and the Feast of Tabernacles. Why would I highlight those three feasts? Tell me what you've heard and learned and remember about those three.
They're the ones that all the males are required to go to each year.
Okay. These three feasts are chief feasts for the Jews. This Day of Atonement, we're not going to put in the same category. It is really, one might think, superior to these three. I'll grant you that. The whole chapter devoted to it in Leviticus. But these three have that unique feature that to celebrate these feasts, you have to do it in Jerusalem. If you're over 30 and a man, you have to do it in Jerusalem. So they are the chief of the feasts in that sense. The one Day of Atonement is the biggest deal of the year, the only day that the high priest can go into the Holy of Holies, for instance. So truly, I'd crown it over the three chiefs. But God had developed a system that really required these people to be rooted in the country that he gave them. If these three times a year, end of March, end of May, start of June, using our months now, and then over here in the end part of October, if you have to be in Jerusalem for each of those times in a year and you wanted to live any appreciable distance away, then you've really created a hardship for yourself, haven't you? What about my crops when I live 100 miles away and now I've got to go be in Jerusalem? Can I be plowing during that time? Well, no, I've got to wait till I work my way back. So now that one's going to work okay. But, you know, I come over here and I got a citrus harvest I'm trying to bring in. Now I've got to abandon it and run off to Jerusalem, hire somebody to do it. That's expensive. God intended for these people to stay home. He intended for these people to be His chosen people in His chosen land, with His chosen city, His chosen temple, and in every way then, these chosen people were to be manifesting to the world what it was to be the people of God. So it's all rooted in a very tiny little country. More on that in a bit, though. The point is, with these three, they're mandatory, and, therefore, something that you have to plan your life around. Now, we're just going to go very briefly over each of these tonight, brethren, and the focus of it's going to be in Leviticus chapter 23 in a moment. We'll get to 1 Corinthians 5 first. But all I'm going to do is take these three chief feasts and one other, and then we're going to look at them briefly tonight by way of an overview. You'll see the same thing developing with the feasts that we saw with the offerings. There's seven chief offerings. There's a lot of overlap in them, but there's a lot of differentiation too. So it becomes extremely complicated, and you need a whole special chosen class of people just to keep that system operating, don't you? We call them the Levitical priesthood. Well, it's going to be exactly the same thing with all these feasts. They are so intricate and complex and time-consuming, you know, and labor-intensive, that it is going to require these same people, these Levitical priests, to be the masters and operators of this elaborate system that God had bequeathed upon the Jews. So, with Passover, I'm not going to do any reading tonight. You're all so extremely familiar with its roots. Let's just summarize this one, and we'll spend a little more time then on some of the others that are a bit lesser known. Passover commemorates what? Their freedom from the bondage in Egyptian captivity. And particularly the Passover, literally meaning to pass over, would be reminiscent then of the passing over of what in the first time they did this? An angel that had come to kill off the firstborn of every living, breathing thing in what country? Egypt. So when they have their Passover meal each year, that Passover meal is reminiscent of God selecting them to be freed from this terrible punishment if only they would sacrifice a lamb, put its blood on the doorpost and the lintel, and the angel would pass over. It is on the 10th day of the first month. But God did foresee that people would be living in some fairly flung areas. And in fact, for some of the tribes, the northern tribes could be a significant distance away from Jerusalem anyway without leaving the promised land. So, if you were somehow defiled, you'd accidentally stepped on a grave, you know, something happened and now you're not clean to partake of the Passover meal, or if for some reason you couldn't make it, an injury maybe or an illness, of course, but for the people that were living far out, they were allowed to come in the second month on the 10th day and have a Passover meal. So they had to have a good excuse. This wasn't something the priest could let go on every year just because you felt like it, I'm presuming. But God did make an allowance in this case for distance and problems with participation. So you've already said all the men that are 30 plus have to attend. It is a yearling lamb. You find a one-year-old lamb, the cutest little thing you can think of. Okay? I know. Because it is, naturally, to the human eyes, just a cute, cuddly thing. And if you see them out in the field and they're all bouncing around and playing with each other, you know, it's just the cutest thing you think that you've ever seen. And so, no doubt, thanks to Facebook, we get those things coming through, you know, every couple of months you're likely to see pictures along those lines. There's nothing prettier, cuter, you know, more appealing and loverly than a one-year-old lamb. But what are we going to do to it? It is going to carry sin. It is going to have its throat cut, its blood shed. It is going to be burnt. It is going to cooked, and it's going to be eaten. It's going to be entirely consumed, lamb or goat, without blemish for each family. Now, some changes took place here. I don't think you know that we need to try to remember. We're not practicing this system now. But it was true in the beginning that they would eat in their homes, and then once they got established in the promised land, was then this 30 plus males have to go to Jerusalem, you know, and so it became a centrally located feast in all those later years. Not one bone of this lamb may be broken. It may not be broken. If that animal has a broken bone, it may not be offered in the as a Passover meal. It will be roasted, and it must all, you'll notice I've underlined, it must all be eaten. So, smaller families would team up with other families. There was to be one per household, but if you were a very small household and you were incapable of eating that entire lamb in a single meal, then you could pitch in on a single lamb and share it, families going together. You're to eat it with unleavened bread and with bitter herbs, and these things would then remind them of what? From the first time the Passover meal was offered. Tremendous haste, okay, and the bitter herbs is likely reminiscent of the fact that then, you know, they weren't extremely well prepared for this journey, and they were going to wind up spending an awful lot of time out there. The foods that they were going to be eating were not the very best and most savory, you know, that the cook could come up with. in the year. So bitter herbs, not a thing that was particularly tasty. It was to carry with it the feel of the first meal eaten in haste in a terrible night, screams of the families as they realize that the firstborn are dead, and then they're being forced out into the wilderness. No uncircumcised foreigner may partake, but anyone who wants to partake of this feast with the Jews is permitted to do so if the males will submit to circumcision. So you had to be pretty committed to this religion and want to participate in the Passover. And if you fail to partake of the Passover, then you are cut off. That does not mean executed in this case, but it does mean cast off. You are not considered a Jew anymore. This is a mandatory feast. This is a thing God requires. This yearly remembrance of those 400 years in captivity, the miraculous manner in which God took them out of that captivity, their freedom from bondage, and their coming to a new land is of such importance that if you won't participate in this singularly and uniquely Jewish pastime, then don't be a Jew. You're out of here. Now, let's have a look, though, at 1 Corinthians 5. This is going to be the one time tonight, brethren, with regard to all of these feasts, that I'm going to introduce an element, of trying to understand typology, symbology. What do these things represent? The Old Testament, we are taught, is full of shadows. The New Testament is the substance. Back in the Old Testament, we have the type over against that. Anti just means over against, not necessarily in conflict. But the corresponding, event, an anti-type, will take place in the New Testament or have manifestations and overtones, remembrances of the previous events in the Old Testament that now are being fulfilled in the New. Here's a perfect case for us where we know exactly how to understand it. 1 Corinthians 5. Now, it's an ugly setting, for sure, but in 1 Corinthians 5:1, it is actually reported that there is fornication and sexual immorality among you, and of such a kind as does not exist even among the Gentiles, that someone has his father's wife. And you have become arrogant, and have not mourned instead, in order that the one who had done this deed might be what? Removed from your midst. For I, on my part, though absent in body but present in spirit, have already judged him who has so committed this, as though I were present. In the name of our Lord Jesus, when you are assembled and I with you in spirit, with the power of our Lord Jesus, I have decided to deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of his flesh, that his spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus. Now, what does all that mean? We're all familiar with 1 Corinthians 5. What they're saying is, if this individual's behaving like this, you people should not have tolerated it. You should have what? Should have cast this person out. You should have cut them off from Christianity, from the saints, from the church. Shouldn't allow them to be a part of your assemblies, and treating them as if they were fine, upright, and upstanding members of Christianity. They're not. So these early verses here are about getting rid of that which is defiled and sinful so that it is not left in association with the main body of the saints. Now, verse 6, your boasting is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? This was a feast in which their bread was unleavened. A little leaven will leaven the whole lump. But in a Passover meal, you don't have any leaven at all. You've taken the leaven out. 7, clean out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ, our Passover, also has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Now, when you're back here in a physical Passover meal under the old law, the bread is unleavened. A lamb, a yearling lamb, has to be sacrificed and eaten. How many of the Jews were thinking, I get it. We're to be a pure and undefiled people with that leaven representing sin, and we then are going to be without any kind of leaven at all. And to atone for our sins, that lamb has to be sacrificed, and that represents Jesus. So we're going to have a sacrificial system now for 1,500 years that will help us to appreciate how we are to be a leaven-free, pure and upright people with no defilement who have been bought back from their sins by the bloody sacrifice of another, which is Jesus, the Son of the living God, typified by that lamb. Now, how many Jews would dig that out? I don't think any of them would be able to see that. But in 1 Corinthians 5, we see the inspired apostle making these parallels. So God was establishing concepts and ideas that would be fulfilled in a spiritual way, in a far superior way, centuries and centuries later. But still, the principle of having to be careful about mixing things and then sacrifice was being planted in these people's minds in preparation one day for their becoming not just Jews among Gentiles, but Christians in the world, the entire world. So, Passover is a very easy one to appreciate. It gets referenced, of course, in many other places than just right here, but is helpful in our seeing God apparently had reasons for everything he expected regarding any of these feasts. So, now we go back to our little chart just long enough to say, okay, we've just talked about the one at the end of March, first part of April, here's our Passover. The next one, that's linked with it is the unleavened bread, so we've got a week of that. We just talked about that. So the next thing that we want to bring up now is the Pentecost itself, down toward the bottom right there. So at this point, we're going to spend the rest of the night, about half an hour, looking at Leviticus 23. That's the purpose of our class, study Leviticus and Deuteronomy. But I'm hoping by collecting these things the way we have, and then thanks to the helpfulness of this 23rd chapter in particular, if we do some early work in subject matter like we are tonight, and we did last week and the week before, then when we go back and we do a sweep through the book of Leviticus, we can hit some of the more obscure things having already covered this material. So, in Leviticus chapter 23, everybody back there, we want to read these verses 4 through 22. Here's our book of Leviticus, dedicated to the priests, teaching them how they are to prepare and to operate all of these feasts, in this case, which will involve some offerings and sacrifices. So, verse 4. These are the appointed times of the Lord. Holy convocations. Anybody know what that word is? What is a convocation?
An assembly.
It's an assembly. So it just means God now is going to give a summary of the big meeting times of the Jews. When all the Jews are to come together, they're going to have a convocation. We would say assembly, but the nation is coming together. So, which you will shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. Verse 5. In the first month, on the 14th of the month, at twilight is the Lord's Passover. So I just summarized that whole thing, and he doesn't say anything more about it here in this chapter. Verse 6. Then, on the 15th day of the same month, there is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day, and I got my charts wrong here. I forgot I was going to do this unleavened thing first. So still the week after the Passover now, verse 7. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. But for 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. So there's our unleavened bread to go with the Passover, just a few verses. Now, verse 9. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I'm going to give you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. Now, on the day when you wave the sheaf, you shall offer a male lamb, 1 year old, without defect, for a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering, you have to have both, shall then be 2/10 of an ephah. Nobody's quite sure what that is, and we're not going to worry about that measuring tool of their time. Shall then be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering by fire to the Lord for a soothing aroma with its libation. Okay, you got convocation. What's a libation? A libation is a liquid offering. There are a number of liquid offerings, oil and wine and combinations thereof, and various, concoctions that the priest were to make up. So there's a specific libation that goes with this one as well. It is a fourth of a hin of wine. Now, if you knew convocation and libation, tell me what an ephah and a hin is, and you get a star tonight. I'm not going to work with those measuring systems. Verse 14. Until this same day, until you have brought in the offering of your God, you shall eat neither bread, nor roasted grain, nor new growth. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations in all your dwelling places. Now, because I messed that up so badly, let me go back and just show you. What we've just finished now are these three feasts that are the spring feasts. Passover is followed by a week of unleavened bread. Then a little bit later, you have your Feast of the First Fruits. We've just read about all three of those in a few verses in Leviticus chapter 23. Much more information was given to the Jews in this book and in other books. We're just using chapter 3 for our summary here this evening. So we've just finished spring feasts. Now, in verse 15, you shall also count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day when you brought in the sheaf of the wave offering, there shall be 7 complete Sabbaths. You shall count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall present a new grain offering of the Lord. You shall bring in from your dwelling places 2 loaves of bread for a wave offering, made of 2/10 of an ephah. They shall be of a fine flour baked with leaven as first fruits to the Lord. Along with the bread, you shall present 7 1-year-old male lambs without defect, and a bull of the herd, and 2 rams. They are to be a burnt offering to the Lord with their grain offering and their libations, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. We studied burnt offerings a couple weeks back. With a burnt offering, what's left when you're done? Nothing. So it's completely destroyed. 19. You shall also offer 1 male goat for a sin offering and 2 male lambs, 1 year old, for a sacrifice of peace offerings. The priest shall then wave them with the bread of the first fruits for a wave offering with 2 lambs before the Lord. They are to be holy to the Lord for the priest. On this same day, you shall make a proclamation as well. You are to have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It is to be a perpetual statute in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. When you reap the harvest of your land, moreover, you shall not reap to the very corners of your field, nor gather the gleaning of your harvest. You are to leave them for the needy and the alien. I am the Lord your God. Now let's look back up at the screen again here. So, we had a Passover. We then had a Feast of Unleavened Bread, 7 days. We then had a Saturday, a Sabbath after that, and now we're going to count that one and six more. We're going to get 7 full weeks, and then on the next Sabbath, 50th, after the Passover, 50 days later, we get this Pentecost, also called the Feast of Weeks. What's Pentecost mean? 50th. You got a comment?
I was going to ask if today in Israel, if they farm and leave the corners for gleaning still. Do you know that?
You know, I believe they do. I don't know that anybody actually goes out and does any gleaning. But I've been there several times, you know, in this season, April through May, and I've seen both standing barley and wheat this high, you know, well above my waist and ready to be cut. And many, many fields I've seen that have been cut. And I would notice that, you know, that you'd have areas around the edge that had not been cut. Here in the United States, we get every last stock, you know, we're really careful about it, and as well, you should be. I mean, that's fine. It's not anything wrong with it. But I'm suspecting that, you know, at least those that are considering themselves to be very faithful, practicing Jews would, in fact, be doing that, even though, again, there's nobody actually doing any gleaning. Okay, so Pentecost, you know, is our 50th right here. But I want to highlight something. How come everybody knew 50th? Why is Pentecost important to us today? Because in Acts chapter 2, it was the day of Pentecost. Okay, but I just read it quickly. But did you see what a day that was? So we need to remember that when that happened, it was at the very end of the Jewish, you know, Mosaic law. This is the very end. Jesus has come and died and risen. We've got 40 more years before it's destroyed in 70 AD. But over 1,500 years of practice, you know, we've come to the last days of this thing. But Pentecost was a day of convocation. It was a day when everybody had... If you were 30 years old and a man, where'd you have to be? In Jerusalem. You bring your wife and your kids, everybody from all over Israel comes, and you don't just come, you come into a gigantic assembly. When did this event take place? Well, it was early in the morning, you know, day of Pentecost. How could they be drunk so early, you know, and all of that? So it was in the morning, I understand that. But it was also on a high holy day where the city was packed with as many people as you can imagine. Josephus says that in his time, he was born about the same year Jesus was raised from the dead. He says there could be 2 million people in the city of Jerusalem at that time. 2 millions in what is a relatively very small area. If you think of a square that's 6/10 of a mile on each side, a little over half a mile, that's all the old city was. You can't put 2 million people in there. As far as the eye can see, the countryside is just overrun with all of these people. And so, they've come for sacrifice, they've come because God has expected this for all these years, and they've come with a view to this being the time of harvest. Both the barley and the wheat are coming to the end now. We had our first fruits feast, now we're coming to the very end of the harvest. Pentecost, Feast of Weeks, is also known as the Feast of Harvest. It's the end of most of their growing seasons. We've got grapes and olives way out here before we start plowing. But really, it's, you know, it's the big end of the mainstay crops. And so on that Pentecost, brethren, this was picked by God for a very particular reason. Lots of people in town. But I'd like to at least suggest now, it's worth at least asking the question, you know, wondering, when we saw in 1 Corinthians 5 God making a point out of these various festivals that they would relate to something in the future, and this is Pentecost, the Feast of Harvest, what happened in Acts 2? Did we not have our first crop of Christians on that day? How many did we bring in on the harvest? 3,000. That's maybe not just coincidental. it is likely, I think, God was intending, without anybody ever being able to see it, that he wanted them to be thinking in terms, though, your various activities in the physical world have counterparts in a spiritual world that will be the fulfillment of all your hopes and dreams, a promised land far better than just Israel, great as it is, and many points of contact. This is our grand, you know, feast of harvest. By the way, Jesus is our Passover, and he was killed. But unlike all those lambs, what happened 3 days later? He rose from the dead. And he is actually referred to, the first one to rise from the dead, as the first fruits, isn't he? Yes, he is. So he's the first fruits. Now we have this general harvest and then the beginning of your regular cycle from then on in a whole new religion that is Christianity. Okay, we're going to be bringing this to a close then with a look here at our Feast of Trumpets in Leviticus 23, verses 24 and 25 comes up next. And by the way, take a good look at that guy. That really is a shofar. That really is a ram's horn. They sell them like crazy in all the souvenir stores, but only once in a while have I seen anybody demonstrate one. And I thought that all of this, you know, apoplectic, about to explode expression on his face was really apt. You got to be good to blow one of these. It takes a lot of air, and so you really got to, you know, have a set of lungs, and you really got to make that thing work. But it has a very distinctive sound, and it can be heard for miles. It is amazing how well those things actually work. So this would be a standard, you know, trumpet that would be used for the Feast of Trumpets. Did they not also have some other trumpets, though? Silver kind. So there were some of those that were employed as well in the old days. But now we've just got two verses on the Feast of Trumpets. So come on over to 24 and 25. Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, so this will be what group of feasts now? Seventh month, we've moved on over to our fall season now. Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder, by blowing trumpets. A holy what? It's supposed to be a big assembly. You shall not do any laborious work, but you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. So there's just a Feast of Trumpets. Now, we'll perhaps learn more about that, you know, to come, but you might consider that one of their lesser feasts, I suppose. And so as we come back to our chart here just momentarily, we came over to our fall feast, we've got trumpets, we're going to look at atonement here very briefly and head on into tabernacles. So, the Day of Atonement in Hebrew is Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur. So you'll hear that term, you know, constantly today. They still make an effort to participate in it to varying degrees. Leviticus chapter 16 devotes the entire chapter to the Day of Atonement. So we'll worry about that one later. I just want to stick with 23 in our overview tonight. Look at verses 26 through 32. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on exactly the 10th day of this seventh month is the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. Neither shall you do any work on this same day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord your God. If there's any person who will not humble himself on this same day, he shall be cut off from his people. As for any person who does any work on this same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no work at all. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest to you. And you shall humble your souls. On the ninth of the month at evening, from evening until evening, you shall keep your Sabbath. Again, that's it, okay. So, Day of Atonement. Now, that one, of course, And I kind of like this particular artist's idea, you know. That one especially is the one where we are brought face to face with the concept of life lost, bloodshed, but with the laying on of the priest's hands and the sending out, you know, into the wilderness of the scapegoat. You know, we have here, of course, his entry into the Holy of Holies and all that. We have the most solemn day in all of Israel's seasons. By the way, this is also the only day in the whole year, this is the only time that the Jews are also required to what? To fast. Fasting has but one day a year in the old Jewish system. This is that. So, has brought us to the Day of Atonement. We can close out now with our Feast of Tabernacles, and that'll take us to the end of this particular chapter. But before we do, have a look at this picture. I have not yet quite decided, but I've never seen this. You know, I've always only been there in April, May, and June, and so this time, this fifth time, I'm going to go in October with Mark Dahl, and whoever else among you will come with us. But I'm thinking I might go a week early, and if I do, it would be largely so that I could see this event. This is modern Jerusalem. It is not the old city, marked out, you know, by Herod's original walls and all that, but it is in an Orthodox part of the city. So there are huge parts of the surrounding city of Jerusalem, the greater city of Jerusalem. It's occupied, of course, by your curly-haired Orthodox Jews, and very, very many of them. And so they, as well as most other Jews, will try to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, which is another word for tabernacles is
tents.
But it's described as having to do with palm fronds, for one thing, but also it really meant temporary. So this is just one way people do. I thought about getting half a dozen pictures. Some people will make a tent, and you can just do it out of sheets. Some people will use a lot of palm fronds, and there's great pictures. You should go to Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem, is what I did, and go look at all the pictures. And there's some great pictures of the funny hats that the Orthodox guys wear and all that. But excuse me again. Oh, I'm glad for that water. Donkeys overloaded with palm fronds, and I saw one I particularly liked. It was a baby buggy that had been stuck through with palm fronds, and they were trying to bring all these palm fronds on, you know, in this carriage. But anyway, a huge number of these people are going to build a temporary structure that's, you know, not palm fronds and not bed sheets, and so the city will fill up with these. And it is a time then of remembrance, of course, for them of what?
Esther.
Pardon me?
Esther's Feast.
No, it's not that one. That's one of those extra ones I was telling you about that they've added. We're not even going to talk about that tonight. But this is reminiscent. It's not a permanent home, so you've got all your wilderness wanderings. They were out there living in their tents throughout the wilderness wanderings. This is the one that is to remind them then of those 40 years. By the way, it only came to be 40 years because of their faithlessness, failure, and sin. Because spies came back, and spies had no faith, and then they convinced everybody else to go ahead, you know, and follow their lead, and none of the rest of the people had faith. You know, everybody died out, you know, under the age of 40, and so it was just terrible. And so This Feast of Tabernacles or Booths is calling to mind punishment for sin and faithlessness, for sin and failure. So let's start with 33. Again, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, on the 15th of this seventh month is the Feast of Booths for 7 days to the Lord. On the first day is a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work of any kind. For 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a holy convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work. These are the appointed times of the Lord which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to present offerings by fire to the Lord, burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and libations, each day's matter on its own day, besides the Sabbaths of the Lord, besides your gifts, and besides all your votive and free will offerings, which you give to the Lord, on exactly the 15th day of the seventh month, when you've gathered in the crops of the land. You shall celebrate the feast of the Lord for 7 days, with a rest on the first day and a rest on the eighth day. Now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees, palm branches and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook. You shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall thus celebrate it as a feast of the Lord for 7 days in the year. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations. You shall celebrate it in the seventh month. You shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths. Pardon me, just dry is all that is. Verse 43, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in booths when I brought them out from the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses declared to the sons of Israel the appointed times of the Lord. It's a good thing I took that haul before I started, right? Those hauls. All right, so we'll bring that class to close in with all of that. Oh, it all caught me at the end here. All right, so anyway, I'm done. But those don't look a lot like palm fronds to me, do you? So as is typically the case, Jews are fond of kind of making do and making over. Today it doesn't look maybe much like it did for the Jews, and I'm not sure that they're actually living in those either, fully 7 days completely out of their homes. But you'll note what each person has done here is each one has their regular house right here. And then what do? They just built it right out in the front. Okay. Just like in the wilderness wanderings, right? not quite. Now, I don't mean to mock them, and I'm not saying even that what they're doing necessarily is wrong. But for the Jews of old, I'm thinking they went out and they built a thing out in the yard somewhere. You can imagine the excitement of the kids and all the rest of that, and all the opportunity to teach. One thing you got to give them: we as Christians, who are under the same responsibility in Deuteronomy 6. To be teaching our children everywhere we go, and inside and outside and everything. I'm not so sure we get it done as well as they did. You got to hand them that. They, because of those feasts, and to whatever degree they actually practiced them, sure spent a lot of time off with their kids, didn't they? Teaching them about the history of their people. We could learn something from that, I think. Okay, any other comments, questions? Right, class dismissed.